I was talking to my friend Tom Betty up in Alaska, and he was talking to me about how, you know, when you get a new car, it's like, oh, everyone be careful. You got to wipe your feet and no drink and no French fries and, you know, no, you know, food of any kind, none of that stuff. And make sure you, you know, you're cleansed and, you know, clean and all this stuff. And then he says, and after a while, I noticed that, you know, things start to change. The car gets a little dirty. The interior doesn't get so doesn't smell like that new car smell anymore. It smells kind of like, you know, an old car smell and things like this. And he was kind of laughing about that. And what he was saying is soon we get comfortable with a formerly new car that is now as old and worn and all spilled soda stain as the old car was that we traded in to get the new car. We kind of reverted backward, in other words. And I always think about that when, in my response to Tom, I said, you know what, I've gone through that same thing, not so much with a new car, but I was thinking of our carpet at our house. You know, 11 years ago, we got a new carpet in our house to replace the old carpet that was there when we moved in. And you all might remember when you first started coming over to our house, what did we have you do? You had to get sterilized. You had to go through some kind of, you know, all kinds of disinfectants and everything. Take off your shoes, wear a face mask, and not bring anything into our house. And we kind of let up on that. And part of the reason was because just bringing traffic into the house wears the carpet out. And now we got stains on it. We got wear patterns. It basically looks just about the same as, if not worse than, the carpet that we replaced. And you know what? I was talking with Honey about this the other day, and I said, you know what? This doesn't bother me so much anymore. You know, when we got the first soda stain, then that really bothered me. I was all stressed about that and upset about that. But now we got stains everywhere, and it's like, you know what? I'm okay with that. That's not really that I'm okay with it. But what I'm getting at is that people learn to live with that sort of thing. We get over the shock, with the disappointment, the desire to save it has worn off. And people get used to damage, and we grow comfortable with wear and tear, and we become resigned to the stains that are all around us. I'm not talking about carpets, and I'm not talking about new cars. What I'm talking about is your own spiritual life. I'm talking about your heart, really. Because I believe that people do the same thing with their spiritual lives. At first, their conscience warns them that there's something wrong and they need to deal with that. Their heart is tender. They want to do what's right. And then we're open and receptive to that gospel call. And when we do respond, we're filled with zeal and enthusiasm. We want to participate. We want to talk to people. We've got all this excitement. And we don't want anything to come and take that away from us. We don't want any stains. We don't want any bad stuff. We want to remove ourselves from all that. And then something happens that we didn't think would happen. We get distracted. We get distracted by worldly plans and worldly pleasures. And we get dazzled sometimes with the glitter of sin. And when we start justifying and rationalizing that sin, we allow bad company to influence our good behavior. And quite honestly, we get tired of trying to be good all the time. And we get lazy about the very patterns and habits that keep us good or kept us good before. What happens is, spiritually speaking, we get comfortable with damaged souls. And we look around, we go, you know what? This isn't so bad. I can deal with this. It's okay. I mean, I'm not a bad person. Yeah, but you're not really a good person either. And you're comfortable with that in that situation. And that's not a good thing at all. A point I'm trying to make here is that we become content with mediocrity. Mediocrity is just kind of the middle point. It literally means middle mountain. I looked it up. It comes from a Latin word which means middle mountain. You're in the middle of the mountain. You're not down at the bottom, but you're not at the top. You're right in the middle. And it's ordinary. It's so-so. It's nothing special. Our spiritual life becomes well-worn. It becomes dirty and sin-stained. It becomes predictable and unimpressive. It becomes lacking in power and lacking in performance. We're living in the shadows, and we're calling it walking in the light. I have a lesson. We're going to talk more about that next week, but I just want you to think about that idea there. And then we read this passage in Revelation 3, particularly in verse 15 and 16, part of what Dobra read for us this morning. Dobra, good to see you up there reading. right? I think that was your first time and did an awesome job. Thank you. But Jesus talks here about the church at Laodicea. I know your deeds. You're neither cold nor hot. I wish you were one or the other. But since you're middle mountain, since you're mediocre, since you're lukewarm, that's disgusting to me. When we look at being cold, we're talking about unbelieving and living accordingly, right? I mean, an unbeliever lives in accordance with his unbelievingness. And we expect that. A hot believer, if you can say it that way, is someone who fully believes and lives accordingly. He believes and he lives in conjunction with or in accordance with or agreement with that belief. But a lukewarm person claims to believe but is not living in accordance. That's an incompatible life, and that's what makes Jesus nauseous and makes him vomit that person out of his mouth. You think about what he's saying there. It's pretty bold language. And I think about this passage here in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, in a positive way. You are a chosen race. He's speaking about Christians as a group here. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. By the way, that comes out of Exodus chapter 19, verse 5 and 6, where God was saying that about Israel initially, that that's what Israel was supposed to be. And now he's saying that this is what we are supposed to be, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. I want you to think about that for a minute. Think about those words. Think about the profound nature of what we are called to be, what we are called to do, and what we are called to how we are called, I should say, to serve, and the God that we are called to serve. We're not called to serve a church building. We're not called to serve a religion. We're certainly not called to serve a preacher. We're not called to serve any of those things. Those things pale in comparison to who we are called to serve and proclaim, and that is the God of heaven. We are called out of the world into his marvelous light so that we might proclaim that light and proclaim the excellencies of that God. We are a blood-bought people who anticipate nothing less than eternal glory with that Creator, with that God. That's something worth proclaiming. But how are you proclaiming it? That's the question it comes down to. If you and I are living mediocre, damaged, and unremarkable lives, how are we proclaiming that message? If our thinking is about mediocre thoughts and practicing so-so behavior and exercising lukewarm convictions, how in the world is that proclaiming the excellencies of God? And my admonition here is, first of all, don't do that, okay? But secondly, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to live that way or think that way. And we're not offering a magic solution here to the situation, because Christians don't believe in or practice magic. And we're not asking for a miracle from God, because God doesn't need to perform miracles to accomplish his will in you. What we are asking each one of us is to believe in the one who can transform you. And what that requires is renewal from within. Not an outside fix. We need to go in where the problem really is. And the problem in that case would be in the heart. And that's what the rest of this lesson is about. You know, usually when we start talking to Christians about being transformed, especially Christians who are in the dumps and depressed about what's going on in their lives and that sort of thing, they automatically think about their circumstances. Have you noticed that? If you talk to someone who's going through a bad health issue and you say you need to be transformed, what's the first thing they're going to tell you in a sense? Well, I would be if I could get rid of this health problem. Or if someone's going through some marital problem, maybe even a divorce or something horrible like that. And what are they going to say? Well, I could be transformed if I could get this resolved or some other thing. If I could get my car working right, or if my job was working right, if everyone cooperated with me, then I could be transformed. There's some real problems with that kind of thinking. What I'm saying is, my situation in the world needs to be reformed, and then I could be transformed in the renewing of my mind. And what God is saying is the opposite of that. He says, be transformed in the renewing of your mind, and it really doesn't matter what's going on in your world. And so you hear people sometimes say, well, if only so-and-so, my friend, my spouse, my boss, you know, my coworkers, whatever, if only so-and-so cooperated with me, well, then I could be the Christian that God wants me to be. But God, that's not what God requires for your faith to be strong and vibrant and effective. If it was, then God is only as powerful as the people that you work with, are married to, or are friends with. Think about it logically. God is more powerful than those people, but yet you're handcuffing God to their decision. That's just not right. And it doesn't make sense, and it violates the biblical pattern. Someone says, well, if I could get a better job and have a better home and make more money, then I would be the kind of person that God wants me to be. Well, that's not true, because that's not what God requires for you to proclaim the excellencies of God. It's not what He's asking for, and that's not what He needs. And again, that handcuffs God to your expectations, to really how you see the world, how you see yourself in the world. And you're saying, God, if you would just do this one thing out here, then I would serve you better. And it's like, that doesn't make sense. Quite honestly, that's called mediocre thinking. Middle of the mountain thinking there. Or if only my circumstances improved, then I could be transformed. That doesn't manifest trust in God, but it manifests trust in something else, something less than God. It's true that God can change your circumstances. We've all seen it. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But it may not be His plan to do so. And if you're imposing upon Him to improve your circumstances before you are spiritually transformed, then you're imposing upon God something that is not necessary in order for you to be His child. And that's basically telling God how He needs to run His world and how He needs to do His job. Who are you to do that? Who am I to do that? Such thinking is what we might call an outside-in approach, where we say that circumstances have a direct and negative effect on my faith. My circumstances have a direct and negative effect on my faith. My faith is diminished and ineffective because of my circumstances. Well, that's outside-in thinking. What God operates on is an inside-out thinking. If your faith is intact, if your heart is pure, if your convictions are sure and based on what they ought to be, it really doesn't matter what happens out here because the inside is taken care of. And all your outside circumstances anyway are going to end when you die. But if your inside isn't taken care of when you die, well, then you're in trouble. So really what we're looking at then is what is the direction of your thinking? Is it outside in or is it inside out? What direction does it go? We're told in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, most of us know this passage. Paul says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by what? The renewing of your mind so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Some of us can practically quote that passage and that's good, but notice what he's saying here, and that is that the renewing leads to the transformation and the transformation leads to proof positive that that transformation really does exist. Visible proof. I want to talk about each one of these stages in the next few moments here, but what I'm trying to say is that the end result is in agreement with the beginning part of that equation. The renewing of the mind leads to ultimately visible proof that the mind actually is renewed, is what I'm saying. And if the proof isn't there, well, then the renewing isn't happening. And if you're looking at your life and saying, I don't have any good proof that there is any renewal going on, then what you should be doing is backing up and saying, why am I not being renewed in my mind? The renewal of your mind is not just about your thinking, it's also what drives your thinking, that is, your heart. Earlier in a different lesson, I think it was a couple weeks ago, we talked about that you can't just change your mind when it comes to resolving to serve God. You can't just make a mental note like, I want to do differently. You have to change the heart as well. You can't just change the one. Both have to change. In other words, you have to have a mental agreement to what is true, and at the same time, you have to devote your human will to that agreement. And that human will is what inspires us to believe and what compels us to act. We call that sometimes conviction. And if you think about the definition of conviction, it's a belief that is so strong that it demands action. You can't suppress it. You can't contain it. You can't stop it. It's a conviction, and therefore it's a belief that has to act. That's your heart. That's not your mind. That's your heart in action. Your mind came to that agreement. Your mind understood that that's what had to happen, but your heart got engaged as well. And that's what has to happen for that renewal to happen, okay? So let's look at another passage here in Ephesians chapter 4. We'll read a few verses here of what Paul says about renewal in another place so we can kind of get some perspective on the particular subject. Look at there in verse 4 of Ephesians, verse 20. He's been talking about the Gentiles, the unconverted, basically, how they're darkened in their understanding and so on, and living in that spiritual darkness. But you did not learn Christ in this way, he says in verse 20. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit. In other words, what he's saying in simple language is you lay aside your own self-serving will, your heart, in order to adopt a new heart. It's really what he's talking about. And that you may be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Well, that mind there doesn't just mean your mental agreement. It means the cooperation of your what you know to be true and also what you're going to do about it. You see what's going on here, okay? So if you think about what Paul said, when you became a Christian, if indeed you have become a Christian, or when you're looking forward to become a Christian, you lay aside the old self, you take upon the new self. And that new self, by the way, is given to you by God. It's not something you make up. It's not something you build. It's something God gives to you to incorporate into your life. And so we're talking about your new thinking, your new conviction, your new allegiance, your new hope. Unfortunately, what happens over time is that many of us don't take care of that new self, so it begins looking and acting and reacting a lot like the old self used to do. Does that sound familiar? New car, old car. New car, nice new, we're all attentive about it and focused on that, but then over time, it just becomes another old car. New carpet, old carpet. Well, we're not concerned about cars and carpets here, okay? That's not my point. We're concerned about something far more important. If we have the new life, a new heart, a new conviction, a new allegiance, and we allow that to deteriorate to what it used to be in the old life, what have you just done? Renewed in the spirit of the mind means several things all at once. Here's some things to think about. First of all, you have to have daily input into feeding and keeping that new life alive. Because it's not going to sustain itself over time if you don't feed it. I guarantee if you didn't feed me, or if I didn't get fed, I would pretty much die, okay, over a short period of time. Probably in a few hours, I would think, because I get... You know, I look forward to meals, all right? So, as you think about it, if you don't feed people, don't feed your children, well, then they die. That's what happens to people that don't get fed. Your new life, your new heart is pretty much the same way. You don't feed it, or you feed it a bunch of junk, well, then it's either going to be die, or it's going to be so sickly it might wish it were dead. So you have to feed your mind with godly input and righteous thinking. Think about what Paul says elsewhere, Philippians 4, verse 8. Dwell upon these things. What things? The things that are right and true and good and pure and wholesome and excellent. Think upon those things. You can't be renewed in your heart and your mind with a steady diet of old thinking and negative expectations. And I'm going to go forward with this thought here in later lessons, that if you are filling yourself with negative thoughts, then it's not surprising you turn out to be a negative person. You programmed yourself for that. Imagine a person who says, well, I wish I had, you know, a good healthy body and good body fat, body mass index or whatever, you know, good ratios and proportions. I wish I were toned. I wish I looked good. But look at what they're eating. They eat a bunch of junk. They eat a bunch of junk food. They eat a bunch of starches and carbs and sugars and fatty foods and sodas and so-called energy drinks, and which is really a bunch of junk. And they just eat a bunch of junk and they expect the outcome to be good. Listen, if you feed your body with all that garbage, then you should expect your body to respond by becoming a body that is garbage laden. Right? Why can't we see the same thing with our spiritual lives? And when we go out into the world after this day, after Sunday, when we all come together and get fed good stuff, And then we go out to the world, and what are we getting fed? A bunch of lousy junk food. I don't mean literally. I mean, I'm talking about the thoughts of the world, the ideas of men, the false religions, all the untruth that's out there. We're getting fed all that junk. You have to decide whether you're going to let that get into your life and affect your thinking, or whether you're going to shield yourself from that and devote yourself to good thinking instead. You make that decision. You determine what kind of person you're going to be. Don't blame it on your parents. Don't blame it on society. Don't blame it on your spouse. Don't blame it on anything else. You decide. God has given you full permission and full control to decide what kind of person you're going to be. The Word of God is not merely to be read. It is meant to be internalized. We might say the same thing about food. It's not merely to be chewed. It's meant to be swallowed and digested, right? I mean, it's the same idea there. It's meant to be digested. It's meant to be assimilated into us. So we need that internalization. That goes beyond just Bible reading. God's not asking you just to read His Bible, although He needs you to read it, but He's asking you to ingest that as well and to digest that food. Godly thinking is not just something we do in a Bible class, but what we're really talking about is something that goes beyond this class. And we're talking about improving your belief window. And if you don't know what that means, it's simply an abstract way of looking at how you see the world. You have a belief window that's in front of you all the time that you create, that you put principles on that dictate what kind of way you want to look at the world. And that belief window, if it's corrupted, which means if it has a bunch of half-truths or false ideas or false conclusions or traditional things that shouldn't be there, etc., if you've got false things on that belief window, well, then that's what you look at yourself and the world through. And what God does, what His Word does, is comes and cleans up that belief window so you can see. And that you can see accurately. Not just so you can see the world like you want to, but so you can see the world and yourself the way it really is and the way that you really are. We'll talk more about that next week. It's a process by which we evaluate all incoming information and also by which we prepare all outgoing communication. Incoming and outgoing. Goes through that window. We also need to accept God's will instead of our own, and not just a blending of the two things, like, well, I want to merge the two. God, you've got your will and I've got mine. I was wondering if we could come together in agreement on... No, that's really not what God is asking. What He's asking you to do is set aside your will in any case where it needs to be set aside, and I'm talking specifically about where God's will needs to have priority and dominance over your life. You need to set your will aside and let God's will prevail. Now, you have your will in deciding, you know, what you're going to eat for breakfast or what kind of car you're going to drive or what you're going to wear in the morning. That's your will. God's not going to have to determine that for you. But when it comes to determining what kind of person are you going to be, or how you're going to love, or how you're going to forgive, or whether you're going to forgive, that's God's business. And it's His will that has to prevail in all those cases. So it's a complete exchange, not I want to merge the two, but rather God's will is now my will. And if you resist God's will, well, you ought not to be surprised that you turn out to be a mediocre Christian, ineffective and stagnant. It's not a surprise. You programmed yourself that way by what you chose to do. This acceptance, if indeed it is there, cannot be just in words. It can't just be something you say. It has to also be in how you live. It is impossible, on that note, to allow chronic sinful behavior, whatever stands opposed to Christ, and at the same time be renewed and transformed in your thinking. Chronic sinful behavior, renewed thinking, incompatible, can't work together. One of those has to go. You're either going to have to get rid of the behavior or you're going to have to forget being renewed in your mind. Because you can't survive with both of those at once. Those are not only incompatible, they are also illogical. They both resist each other. They're both antagonistic to each other. Also, you need to trust God to direct your life versus you trying to control your life. I see a lot of control stuff going on when I talk to people. Not just you guys, okay? I don't want you to think, oh, he's talking about me. No, I'm talking about just people in general. I see a lot of control issues out there. And I see it even in myself sometimes. I've seen it a lot in the past, but I've been working on it. But I still see manifestations bubbling up to the surface of I want to be in control rather than God. When you try to control your life, you're trying to control what people do to you. You're trying to control what people do for you, or you're trying to control how things turn out or how you want them to turn out. You're trying to control everything that happens to you. You're trying to control that. Now, I'm not talking about expectations by themselves. I expect people to be good and decent, and I'm going to be disappointed by that. But I'm not trying to control people to be good and so on. You see what I'm saying? So I can have an expectation that they be this way, and they're going to disappoint me, and I can even disappoint myself. But at the same time, I'm not trying to take control of their situation for them and make them into something that I want them to be. That's different. That's controlling. Someone says, well, I do trust God. Well, excellent. If you do, that's what you, where you need to be. But if you're only happy and content when your prayers get answered exactly the way you ask them, when things go only exactly as you plan them, and when people respond only exactly as you want it, otherwise you're unhappy, then you are the one who is promoting your control rather than giving yourself over to God's control. You are practicing outside-in thinking rather than inside-out. You're not at peace until all your outside ducks are in a line, or, you know, people are cooperating, and then you can have peace within. Only when everyone cooperates and only when the circumstances are just right, the planets are lined up and the sun is shining, birds singing, angels singing, you know, puppies, butterflies, all that stuff that you would think that would be just ideal for the perfect life, then you're at peace, then you're serene, then you are complete. And that's the wrong kind of thinking altogether, because it's just not going to happen, for one. And secondly, it goes against everything God is telling you. What he says is you can have that serenity within. And then it really doesn't matter whether people follow through or don't, or circumstances are good or bad, or your day is really good or really crummy. It really doesn't matter. You are at peace with God. That's inside-out thinking. There's a big difference between I have full confidence in God only if, and saying, I have full confidence in God no matter what. The first is lukewarm. The second is hot. And that's what Jesus wants you to be. He wants you to be hot in that sense. Let's talk about this word transformation, because I don't know that transformation means what everyone thinks that it means. What it doesn't mean is that everything in my world will suddenly start changing for the better, and then I'll be happier. Well, again, that just describes what I talked about, that outside-in thinking. What it really means is my heart will be increasingly conformed to that of Christ. Regardless of what's going on in my life, in my marriage, in my friendships, in the economy, in society, in this congregation, at this very hour, it really doesn't matter. I'm not going to say that those things don't affect you at all or that you don't have to deal with them. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is those things do not change who you are and the beliefs that you have and the trust that you give to God. It doesn't change that at all. Because if you think about it, God's concern is always about drawing you closer to Him, not perfecting your circumstances, not taking away all your problems, not making everyone like you, not bringing you into financial prosperity. These latter things all end once you leave this world. But how close to God are you? Well, that doesn't end. That situation doesn't end when you leave this world. That has every bearing on the world to come. And if you leave this life being close to God, well, then you've got nothing to worry about in the life to come. But if I guarantee if you leave this life being separated from God because you wanted God to do everything else for you than what He promised, you're going to have a lot of trouble in the life to come. Which is to say, you're never going to be happy. You're not happy now, and you certainly won't be happy then. And it doesn't have to be that way. The very word transformation, as used in Romans 12, verse 2, you know, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. That word transformed there from the Greek comes from a Greek word which literally means what you see on the screen, to change into another form. It's the same Greek word from what we get metamorphosis, or to change in that sense, right? It's the same Greek word there. But you can't change your heart if you refuse to change your mind. And you can't change your heart if you refuse to change your beliefs. Or you can't change your heart if you refuse to change how you process information. especially about what seems radical up front in the Bible, but is actually true. Like what Jesus says about discipleship, for example, which I'm going to save for another lesson or down probably next week here. You have some notes on that, but I'll get to it later. So often you hear people say something to the effect of, well, I want to grow spiritually, and that's a good resolve to have, but that same person refuses to think any differently than they've always thought. It's like the guy who says, I want a model body. I want to be strong and healthy, but he's constantly eating the same stuff he's always eaten, which has made him flabby and disproportionate and all these other things where he is right now. I want to be that. I just don't want to change anything I'm doing. Well, how's that going to happen exactly? You're asking for a miracle. God doesn't need to perform miracles. Remember, we talked about it. Or you're asking for magic, and God doesn't dabble in magic, and neither should you. In believing what he's capable of doing, that is, all right? So that person needs to stop being a subjective thinker and like, how is this truth going to affect me personally? And they need to start thinking objectively and saying, what is true, no matter what? Regardless of how it affects me, regardless of what I have to do, I need to know what is true. That is called objective thinking. It is also called critical thinking, which is exactly what we're after. We want to be critical thinkers. We want to think objectively. I've heard many times someone saying something to the effect of, well, that perspective or that conclusion that you're bringing out, Chad, in your studies, is different than what I've always heard from my family, from my preachers, from the congregations I've attended, from the books I've read, from the studies I've engaged in. And what that is telling me up front, I just have to be honest with you, what that's telling me that is that you're evaluating new information not objectively, not on the objective merit of whether that information is right or wrong or good or bad, but simply by comparing it to your old information. It's exactly what you told me without saying it. Did you hear what I just said? I'm saying that if you hear something new about God's Word that doesn't jive with your old understanding of God's Word, and you reject it simply because it doesn't jive with the old thinking, you're not being objective, you're being subjective. You're saying, how does this conclusion affect me personally? Well, it affects me negatively because I'm going to have to change, and that means I was wrong about this and that, and I can't accept that, so you must be wrong. That doesn't work. Well, it works for you, maybe. But it doesn't work in the long run, and it doesn't help you. It doesn't help you grow, is what I'm getting at. If what you are already convinced is true, will always be true, and therefore unchangeable and unchallengeable. If that's where you're at, any of you, if that's where you're at, you're not going to change. You're not going to grow. You're going to be the same person you are right now forever. So don't come to me and tell me that, Chad, I want to grow. I just don't want to change anything I believe or think about. You're not going to grow. I'm telling you straight up, you're not going to grow. How in the world is the mind or the heart going to be transformed by God or anything else, for that matter, if you refuse any new information or refuse to see what you thought was familiar information in a new light, or if you only accept information that agrees with what you want to be true? I have a lot to say on this over the coming months here, and you've probably heard it already, that resistance in any form, on any level, is basically you telling God, I want to be in control. It is not compatible with surrender and compliance. It is quite the opposite. Remember, these two things can't work together. You can't say, on the one hand, I want to change, and then resist the very things that have to be put into place in order for you to change. And if you're thinking that way, I'm imploring you to reconsider how you're approaching this whole subject of your heart. Resistance is a sign of control. Just think about that. We'll revisit that later, okay? The final part of Romans 12, verse 2, Paul says, so that you may prove what the will of God is. I want you to think about that for a minute. Prove what the will of God is. In Ephesians 5:17, it says that we need to know what the will of the Lord is. Well, knowing and proving are two different things. One necessitates the other. I can't prove what I know unless I know it. But once I know it, I need to prove it, don't I? And so I also need to make sure that it is my reality. I need to put what I claim to believe into action. And that is a sign of an honest and sincere conviction, what we call a belief so strong that it demands action. And if your belief is so strong in Christ, belief is so strong in what he says, that it does have to be put into action, well, then you're going to prove God's will within you. You're going to do what needs to be done, no matter what anyone else says, regardless of who else does or doesn't do it. You're going to do what is right because it is right. Remember, moral courage, or what we call moral excellence. That's what that's all about there. We talked about that in a recent lesson. So if you think about this, we're going to put it back into the words Jesus used to the church at Laodicea there in Revelation 3. A cold conviction refuses to trust God but doesn't try to live otherwise. I wish you were hot or cold. Cold means you're not in, you didn't make any promises, and you're going to live that way. I'm living like I didn't make any promises to God, and you know, okay, we expect that. Okay, a hot conviction, using Jesus' language there, claims to trust God and also offers consistent and visible evidence that that claim really is true to that person. Why? Because they're living it. They're living in conformity to what they claim to believe. Whereas a lukewarm conviction claims to trust God, but the attitude, the outlook, the behavior, yes, and even the love that they manifest does not improve as measured over time. It doesn't change. It doesn't get better. It doesn't metamorphose. Okay? It doesn't get transformed because it's the same person claiming one thing, doing quite another. Jesus says, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth if that's how you're going to be. I didn't say that. That's what he said to that whole church there in Laodicea. Lukewarm is analogous to a fig tree sprouting leaves but no fruit. It's the appearance of something good but without substance. It's like the Laodicean said, I am rich and in need of nothing, but you don't realize that you're poor and blind and naked. And I'm asking you to ask yourself, which one of those am I? Am I hot? Am I cold? Or am I trying to be lukewarm and justify that? You and I as Christians are called to proclaim the excellencies of God. That's a good thing. That's a positive thing. I hope you look at that as a great privilege, because it is. But you can only do this if you're striving for excellence in yourself. You can't proclaim the excellencies of God and then strive for mediocrity, because you're going to reach the mediocre thing. You're going to hit that, and then what? You got nothing else to strive for. You need to strive for excellence in yourself as you're proclaiming the excellencies of God, not striving through your own methods or your own efforts or your own execution of your own plans, but giving yourself, giving your heart over to God. Not just your mental consent, but your heart, the center of yourself, if you will. Give that over to God's care. Surrender your will. Because spiritual renewal begins with a mental agreement, but it requires, it necessitates a full conviction of the heart in order to become reality. We're not saying what the world says. Believe in yourself. That's what the world teaches. And then you look at what the self is that it's believing in, and it's just corrupted with all kinds of false information and all sorts of things. What we're saying, what God is saying, is believe in God. Put your belief in someone who is capable of delivering, capable of helping, capable of transforming you. So I'm asking you and I to examine ourselves. Are we allowing our mind and our heart to be renewed? Are we open to new insights from God's Word? Are we willing to let go of old thinking in order to adopt Christ-like thinking? And if you answered yes to all of those, which I hope that you did, but if you did answer yes to all of those, can we see it? Are you proving what the will of the Lord is, or are you just thinking about it? Because I need to see the evidence in your life, and you need to see it in mine. If I were to come up to you and tell you, I've grown in this last year, but you don't see me as doing or thinking or becoming anything different than I was a year ago, I am deluding myself, and I'm just a bunch of words. And so are you, if that's what you're doing. You're just all talk, and you don't have to be that way. We don't want you that way. God doesn't want you that way. You can't be renewed and transformed if you refuse to do what it takes to be renewed and transformed. You can't expect something new and better to come from something that is done wrongly in the first place, right? Can't expect better results from doing an incorrect thing over and over. You can't move forward if you're content to sit still. You can't draw near to God if you've gotten very used to a well-worn, comfortable, familiar life with all its stains and spots and blemishes. Again, I'm not talking about new cars to becoming old cars or new carpets becoming old carpets. I'm talking, unfortunately, about new hearts and new lives and the new self becoming very much like the old self because you didn't take care of the new self. That's a danger that we need to guard against all the time. We're told in Galatians 3, verse 3, if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Well, there it is, right there. Paul said it, and it wasn't something that I came up with. The Laodiceans thought that they were something. Jesus says, you're nothing. Not because they couldn't have been something, but because he's speaking simply as things stand right now. You are not what you think you are. Well, I'm asking you, how do things stand with you right now? Are you what you think you are, or are you something different than what you think you are? If you truly wish to draw near to God, well, then give your heart completely over to God's will. Don't tell him what to do. Instead, do what he told you to do and let him do the rest. And all will be well. It will. It will be well with you. You'll have that peace that you're looking for. You'll have that serenity within. And it doesn't matter what this world does, either to you or for you or against you or apart from you. It doesn't matter what is happening externally. You are at peace within because you are really united with God. And that's where he wants you. That's where you need to be. If there's anyone that is subject to our invitation, we traditionally offer an invitation, allowing people to come forward if they want to or need to respond to our lesson, especially to become baptized if they're interested in doing that, or ready to do that, I should say. And this is your time. If you need to come forward, do so as we stand and sing the song Richard selected for us.